7 in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. Many residents of central Paris look down on the scruffier neighborhoods on the city's periphery. One of those banlieues is about to host the Summer Olympics. Our correspondent talks to planners and residents to see how it will be leveled up. And the iron lung seems like a bit of medical technology from distant history. Not so. Our obituaries editor looks at the scarcely believable life of Paul Alexander, an author and lawyer who spent most of his life in one between 1952 and last month. But first, recently, we've been telling you about the drastic plans that Argentina's newish president, Javier Milei, has to fix his country's economy. But for years before that, we told you about the distortions behind the mess. A money printer just kept going brrr under previous governments. Amid the debt defaults and endless IMF talks, there were price controls, capital controls, all kinds of band-aids, plasters to cover deeper wounds.
An economic crisis worsening by the day. Argentina becoming unaffordable for a century.
Inflation rates of over 100% have become the norm, and an increasing share of the population is slipping into poverty.
There seems to be no light at the end of the tunnel for Argentina's economic crises. The South American country is currently spiraling as it...
Enter Mr. Milei. A trained economist and self-proclaimed anarcho-capitalist who promised to reverse the spiral. The message landed. He was elected in November, took office in December. So how is that program of change going?
Having passed 100 days in office, Mr. Milei, I think, can really boast of some real economic successes. And he's also managed to do that whilst keeping his popularity, his polling, up pretty high.
Kinley Salmon writes about Latin America for The Economist.
But Argentines are suffering very, very deeply already from the economic crisis and indeed from some of the fixes. And the longer that continues, the less likely Mr. Milei is going to be able to keep doing the fixes he thinks he needs.
And we talked a lot on the show about what he plans to do. Let's go through what he's actually done in those first 100 or so days in office.
Yeah, well, it's certainly been a busy 100 days. He's done really three big things. The first, and the one that's caught all the headlines, is that he's cut government spending by a huge degree. He's partly done that by cutting outright, and he's partly done that by letting inflation run far ahead of what the budget is providing, so things fall in real terms. And that's helped him get two monthly surpluses for the government. The second big thing he's done is he devalued the peso by over half. And then third, you know, he or the central bank, although there's close coordination, cut interest rates. That's slightly surprising. Normally, central banks would raise interest rates to fight inflation. But their rationale was that they needed to cut rates partly to reduce interest payments on bonds issued by the central bank. And by doing that, they can reduce the amount of money circulating and in turn, hopefully, pull down inflation.
And did that work?
Well, inflation first jumped up. That was partly inevitable because of the change in the exchange rate. Annual inflation is now well above 200%. That's about the highest in the world. But it is now trending downwards, and that's what the government's keen to emphasize. In February, month-on-month inflation was 13%. That was below what was expected for the month. That was also lower than January. And then, you know, other things have been going in the right direction too. I mean, the gap between the official exchange rate and the black market has also shrunk, thanks in part to that large devaluation. We've seen Argentina's stocks of foreign currency grow a bit, and that really matters for its ability to pay bills to people overseas and indeed to pay debts to people overseas. And all of this is certainly pleasing some important players. The IMF, which has a very large loan program with Argentina, is pretty happy so far. Markets have also been responding well. Measures of Argentina's country risk, which looks at the likelihood of default, has been improving. There are real signs of progress amongst the pain.
Yeah, about that pain, I guess a lot of this has been hard for Argentine voters to swallow.
Yeah, absolutely. It is just an extremely painful process. These fixes are meant to get inflation under control, and it is trending in the right direction. But in the meantime, each month increases in the prices of things in double digits is just very difficult for people to stomach. The other measures that Mr. Milei has taken, in particular the sort of slashing of spending, is pushing the economy into a recession. About half of the country is now in poverty, up from 38% in September. And that inflation also just hurts everyone's purchasing power. By one estimate, salaries are now back to about 20 years ago in terms of what they actually purchase. The rest of the year is going to be tough. You know, Barclays, a bank, reckons the economy is going to shrink by about 4% this year.
And Kinley, I know you're an economist by training. Is this the way to go about it? Is this pain absolutely necessary and worth it?
Well, look, that's a question that divides Argentines very much. I think ultimately, if it does succeed in bringing down inflation, then most economists would say yes. But of course, there's a heated debate about the exact measures to get there and whether being quite so radical, quite so fast was really necessary. And plenty of people think that it might have been possible to get similar results with slightly less pain. But I would say that unfortunately, plenty of pain was just inevitable given the situation Mr. Milei inherited. The bigger question is whether it will ultimately truly work, because they aren't there yet. And there's plenty of uncertainty left in the economic plan. The state, for example, is slowly devaluing the currency further. That's an attempt to try to anchor down inflation. But at some point, Argentina will need a kind of full new monetary policy and exchange rate policy regime. And it's at the moment quite uncertain what that will be. In the campaign period, Mr. Milei promised dollarization and made a great deal of that. But now there seems to be a move to back away from that a little bit. There's more talk of currency competition where dollars and pesos could both be used and people could choose whichever they prefer. But that uncertainty, you know, it will soon get in the way, I think, of some of the positive progress. People need to know where this is going. And then, of course, you know, forcing recession isn't a way to attract investment typically. So you're looking for foreign investment to help get a quick recovery. This process might be putting that off too.
But as you say, there's something of a clock ticking here in that there's only so much pain voters can be expected to endure before his popularity is going to start to fall, no?
That's exactly right. And the problem is made worse by the fact that he doesn't have many other political allies. He has only 15% of the seats in the lower house. He has no governors that are formally in his column. And so if people do turn, he'll be politically very exposed. And we've seen that already to some degree. One of his decrees was voted down in the Senate.
Afirmativos 25, negativos 42, 4 abstenciones.
That was an important, if for the moment, symbolic loss.
Podemos dinamizar la economía, hacerla moderna y competitiva. Senador. Pero no a los golpes, no a los enojos, sino con un verdadero diálogo. Por eso voy a votar en contra.
And he also had his big reform bill picked apart and then he had to withdraw it. So there is a weakness there that could be compounded if his popularity falls too.
So how do you see him threading this needle then? I mean, what should we be expecting in the next 100 or so days?
There are signs his government's increasingly conscious of this tricky path that they need to walk. Notably, they recently delayed further cuts to some subsidies for energy and transport. That's probably partly to try and keep people on side. And Mr. Milei's also made one other big move. He announced what he's called a May Pact, a set of free market principles that he wants to get these influential governors to sign on to. So this is part of a wider attempt to try to negotiate with both Congress and these powerful provincial governors. And there seem to be efforts to strike a deal that might include the reinstatement of income taxes, plenty of which goes to the provinces directly, an exchange perhaps for some emergency economic powers going to Mr. Milei, maybe even for pension reform, which is a really key part of the fiscal problem. So there may be a deal that he's trying to get through around this May Pact before the end of May. But it's not at all clear yet if this will come through. What is, though, I think very clear is that Mr. Milei needs wins fast, because as we've discussed, Argentines aren't going to tolerate this level of economic pain for that long. And if he fails at that, his political rivals are going to seize on his falling popularity to block him even more and probably to try to chuck him out altogether.
Kinley, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
Paris is preparing to host the Olympics this summer, and I've been walking around the northern suburbs of the French capital to see how the building works are getting on.
Sophie Petter is The Economist's Paris bureau chief.
On one of my trips to the Paris suburb of Saint-Denis, I was really struck to see both this new 40-story tower, which is going to house a luxury hotel, rooftop bar, swimming pool. It presumably will have amazing views of Paris when it's finished. And very, very close by the River Seine, they are finishing off the Olympic Village. This is where the athletes are going to live. There will be 10,500 of them, and the flats, it's a huge area of blocks of flats leading down to the river. At the moment, it feels like a ghost town, but it's going to feel incredibly busy when they start arriving later this year. And then if you take a short walk over the railway tracks, there's a sort of intersection of two motorways which you have to cross as well. You then get to the real centrepiece of the Paris Olympic project, and that is the new aquatic stadium. It's housed on a former gasworks, but they have really cleared and flattened the land, and there's a long walkway which is going to be landscaped. It's very beautiful. It's got a sort of curved, concave roof made out of pine that is sourced both in France and in Finland. And the French president, Emmanuel Macron, opened this on April the 4th.
Alors, merci à toutes et tous. Vive la République, vive la France, et vive nos Jeux Olympiques et Paralympiques.
All of these developments are part of an attempt to use the Olympics to revive Seine-Saint-Denis. This is the suburb that hugs both the northern and the eastern edge of Paris. And French urban planners hope that this will really, in the long term, help reshape the capital.
And what is Seine-Saint-Denis like today? What is it changing from?
Well, in the 60s and the 70s, when a lot of migrant workers were recruited, often from parts of North Africa, to come to France, there was a need for new housing. So you have tower blocks all the way around the ring of Paris almost that are still there, but are increasingly looking pretty run down. And the area is the deprived sort of other side of Paris. If you look at the poverty rate, it's 28%. That's twice the average in the capital. Almost a quarter of families in Seine-Saint-Denis are headed by a single parent. And when I spoke to one of the organisers of the Olympic Games, he told me that half of 10-year-old children in this part of the northern suburbs do not know how to swim. So the objective of all these building and attempt to lure investment into Seine-Saint-Denis is that the authorities want the Olympics to help turn around the area's fortunes and shift the way people think about the capital's northern periphery.
That sounds like a project that's going to well outlast the Olympics and cost a pretty penny, no?
Well, it's the scale of investment is eye-watering. I looked at the new station in Saint-Denis, which is going to be part of the metro network, and it's going to be fabulous when it opens. That will be in time for the Olympic Games. But there's a much bigger project to create a loop of 200 kilometres of driverless, so automated metro lines that go all the way around the outside of Paris with 68 new stations. And this is something called the Grand Paris Express. And the whole point of it is that instead of carrying people as the current metro lines do in and out of the city and in and out of the historic centre. It will also link the outskirts to each other and to the city's airports in the north and the south. But the cost of it, as you mentioned, Jason, is 42 billion euros. That's $45 billion. It's eye-watering.
So clearly this is about much more than just the sporting facilities that the Olympics will leave behind.
Well, I think it is. I spoke to Marie Barsac. She is in charge of legacy planning at Paris 2024, the Olympics organising committee. She told me that the idea is for the Games to leave behind facilities and transport for the area in a way that will create jobs and will boost skills for the local people. I mean, for example, the company that is going to be preparing and making all those meals for the athletes in their village is going to recruit its staff locally. They're currently doing that. Or if you look at swimming pools, there are a number of projects to renovate and to build new swimming pools across Seine-Saint-Denis, not just the aquatic centre, which is going to be left for the local population. It'll be a fantastic resource for them. But that is all part of building us a better future for this area.
I hate to ring a cynical note here, but this is kind of always the story before the Olympics comes to a town that wants great things to happen and to be left in the wake of the Olympics. Can we be sure that's going to happen for Paris?
Well, of course it is. And I think Paris has learned the lessons of other cities. Athens in particular is always cited as the example where there was huge investment in stadiums that were then abandoned for years afterwards. London Stratford is a bit of a better example. It has managed to lure in private investment. I think that the lesson that the Paris authorities have learned is that it takes time. It takes huge public investment to make this happen. And it's really about not creating these extravagant vanity projects that then just pile up debt and leave little else behind. And what Paris is trying to do is, apart from the new aquatic centre, focus all the sporting events, almost all of them, on its existing facilities.
But this is more about just building facilities that work for their intended purpose. But you mentioned also kind of transforming the periphery itself in a more general sense. How does that part look?
Well, it's a daunting prospect because the greater Paris region is very divided. You have the historic, well-known part of Paris with all its monuments and its cobbled boulevards and squares. And then you have the outer periphery where even people who live in Paris rarely venture. And people who live there feel that. Locals that I spoke to feel that their address, that's the department code 93, really does stigmatise them. Some people I spoke to in Saint-Denis felt that the games wouldn't change much. But when I was talking to a group of young men just outside the new metro station about to open in Saint-Denis, Pleyel, one of them was unexpectedly optimistic.
Grâce à leur architecture exceptionnelle, Saint-Denis, ça va être super beau après les JO.
He tells me there will be a before and an after for Saint-Denis. After the games, Saint-Denis will be super beautiful.
Sophie, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Jason, for yours.
As a small child, Paul Alexander loved being out in nature.
Anne Rowe is The Economist's obituaries editor.
He loved rolling on the ground in the Texas dirt or creeping through the bushes and catching frogs in the creek and being nuzzled by cows. It all made him feel amazingly alive. And it was one day as he came in from that sort of play, barefoot, that his mother looked at him and realised that he was running a tremendous fever. And he had in fact caught polio, which back then in the 1950s was a terrible killer of children, and thousands went down with it in America. He had to be taken to the hospital straight away, and when he woke up, he seemed to be confined in some way. But he realised that his limbs couldn't move, so he couldn't touch whatever was keeping him in. And also, he couldn't speak because he'd had to have an emergency tracheotomy to suction out his lungs. All he could see, because he had a breathing tent over his head, was a dim shape of his mother. He was only staying alive at all because he was encased in an iron lung.
Invented in September 1929 by Professor Philip Drinker of Harvard, here's iron lung getting demonstration in Boston Hospital. Even though dangerously stricken, this boy can breathe. It's thrilling advance in war against needless loss of life.
In a great big metal tube, which pulled air out of the tube and brought it in again in order to push air into his immobilized lungs. If he'd left the tube for just a little time in the open air, he would have died. So this was his new indispensable companion, and he had rather mixed feelings about it. It was obviously now a part of his life forever because he was paralyzed from the neck down. So he had to get used to its whirring and chugging. He could feel quite tender about it sometimes, as if it was a friend, and called it she. But then again, it was his prison, so he never really settled in his opinion about it, but he knew he couldn't live without it. His determination, however, was so extreme that he managed to get through hospital, 2 years of it, where he found the doctors callous about him, thinking he might as well die, and the nurses very untrained. And he decided to make his escape by not eating any food and therefore becoming so weak that the doctors would recommend he was just taken home to die. And so he was taken home, which of course was his ruse to get back to his mother's wonderful cooking. And once he was there, he thrived. He thrived especially because his father, who was good at making gadgets, made him a lot of plastic sticks, which he could attach to brushes and pens and pencils, and he could paint and write. From there, his mother taught him to read, and other people homeschooled him. And he did so well, he actually graduated second in his class from high school, although he'd never actually been to the building. He went to Southern Methodist University. And from there, he went to the University of Texas Law School. He did so well there and passed his bar exams that he set up a law office in Dallas where he would surprise his clients by meeting them lying in his iron lung so they saw a horizontal lawyer and not what they expected. He even went on to fulfill a great dream of his to be a trial lawyer, and there he would appear in court in a three-piece suit and a special wheelchair that kept him standing upright. So it was clear from all this that he had done something quite extraordinary, which was when he was still quite young and in the early years of polio, he'd managed to learn to breathe on his own. He had to use undiscovered throat muscles to force the air back into his lungs. And he had to keep his epiglottis open so it didn't block his windpipe. He kept on practicing and practicing this frog breathing, as he called it, forcing the air through his throat into his lungs. And he could manage to do longer and longer spells outside in a wheelchair, which meant that after he'd had his lessons at home, his friends could come and get him and they could go back to the creek again or back into the woods. And he began to have a proper sociable life. It meant, too, that when he went to university, he was able to attend the classes. The difficult part was forming friendships again. It was very difficult to fit in with other human beings, even with his family, although his brothers came and helped him, and he was always being helped by bodies of people. He needed their help very insistently, and this did put some people off. He did manage, however, to find love. And this was a marvellous thing. Now that he could breathe by himself, he was able to take girls out and kiss them and have the sort of life a young man would want to have. But when he asked the first girlfriend, whom he was most fond of, if she would marry him, although she said yes, her mother could only see the iron lung and this tedious burden for years and years for her daughter of having to care for this man. In fact, this was the pattern always, that his friends and those who were close to him could see the man, whereas others could only see the machine. And they knew that inside that machine there was a man who could also escape to smell the honeysuckle, to sit on the ground and watch the flowers and the grass, and who could manage to feel, at last, someone else's warm and loving embrace and not just the cold metal of the iron lung.
Anne Rowe on Paul Alexander, who's died aged 78. That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. The show's editors are Chris Impey and Jack Gill. Our deputy editor is John Joe Devlin, and our sound engineer is Will Rowe. Our senior producers are Rory Galloway and Sarah Larniuk. Our senior creative producer is William Warren. Our producers are Maggie Kadifa and Benji Guy, and our assistant producer is Henrietta McFarlane. We'll all see you back here tomorrow for The Weekend Intelligence.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.